Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Today we welcome Amy Krauss Rosenthal, New York Times bestselling author of both adult and popular children's books. In fact, she's written over 20 children's books. She's also a filmmaker, a radio show host, and blogger. But she's probably best known for two projects. Her memoir, Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life, which was named one of the top 10 memoirs of the decade by Amazon's editors. And her film project, The Beckoning of Lovely, one of the very first flash mob videos that you can still see on YouTube. The Beckoning of Lovely first occurred on August 8th, 2008 at 8:08 p.m. or 080808. She produced a video asking people to meet at the Anish Kapoor Bean Sculpture in downtown Chicago, and it ended up producing a crowd of around 400 people rather than the 30 to 40 she expected, and they found themselves singing, dancing, blowing bubbles, meeting new friends, giving flowers to strangers, or as Rosenthal puts it, making the most of your time here. Subsequent events have occurred on 9909, 101010, and 111111. She's been a frequent speaker at TED conferences on the idea of living life in the moment, and since that time, she's embarked on a two-year blogging experience with WBEZ, the public radio affiliate in Chicago, producing similar Living Life Together gatherings for the website missionamykr.com. But probably the best site to see her very quirky work is her website, whoisamy.com. Amy Krauss Rosenthal joins us today on Studio Tulsa. Amy Krauss Rosenthal, thanks very much for joining us here on Studio Tulsa.
Thank you so much for having me.
In your books, your videos, and projects, there seems to be a very central theme at the heart of most of them, which is making the most of everyday life, being in the moment, expecting the unexpected and enjoying it, and enjoying the power of coincidence or serendipity or however you describe it. I was wondering, where did that philosophy come from? Was it always been a part of you growing up?
Oh my gosh, that's such a good question. Well, I guess there's two really different ways to answer that. It's sort of the culmination of everything, I suppose, which is not a very interesting answer. But I think the truth is that in large part, we are who we are from an early age, and as I hear it from my parents, I have been a bit mortality-focused ever since I was very small. Just, like, for some reason, and really not in a dark way, even though that's funny to say, like, how could that not be dark? But as a kid, I really was cognizant of, like, oh my God, this is all going to end. That's such a bummer. Let's do this stuff now. And you know, my dad would, like, rolling his eyes, you know, you're seven. What are you talking about, you know? So maybe it was inevitable I grew up to be a writer and talk about these things.
So you were always aware from a very early age of this was a finite journey.
Yes, I have really vivid memories of being a child and sitting on the sidewalk of my subdivision in the 70s and trying really hard to look around and take it all in and remember the detail of this moment. And like, and I would do that throughout my childhood, be like, stop, look around. And I have this kind of photograph of this first time I'm describing really clear in my memory. And I don't remember a lot of stuff. I don't have the world's best memory, but like, I remember that day. Just like, I'm alive and this is cool. Look around and someday you're going to be a lot older remembering this.
And, of course, that's something that your books and videos reflect, this whole idea of making the most of your time here. And your book, The Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life, I love the fact that it was, you know, I'm average person. I have no pathologies. I have no, you know, hidden secrets in my background, and I'm just telling my story.
It reflects, you know, every inch of my soul and being, and, you know, it's a pretty raw piece of work. And the lens people have, that their own personal lens actually informs their experience of reading the book. So there are people, fortunately many people, who have the reaction that you've just stated. But, you know, you could, just to put this out there, you could look at the book or glance at the book and be like, this is just thoughts about life, and what's this? It's not even a narrative. It's not a linear story. These are just random thoughts about being human. What? And you'd be right, you know? It's a flavor. You're going to either really enjoy it and it works for you, or you're going to be like, I don't know what this is about.
I think you found an audience, though, that does think about that and so seldomly hear it reflected in our contemporary culture. So much of everything that happens is either important or unimportant, and you're making the unimportant important.
And it's also, to some degree, what we deem as important is unimportant. And it is the seemingly unimportant that's important. And the majority of our lives are made up of all these small moments, right? We're not having, like, epic happenings every, you know, 20 minutes. Those are the big and few and far between markers. But sitting on the, you know, the steps of your home watching your kid test out their new sneakers and running up the block showing you how fast they can run because of their new sneakers, like, to me, that's a really important moment. And, you know, here's the thing that I find fascinating. This book has turned out to be a mirror. And since its publication, I've heard from thousands of people around the world of all ages. And guess what? 16-year-olds and 75-year-olds email me the exact same thing. And they say, oh my gosh, this is me. How did you know? You're in my brain. It's unbelievable to me.
That example you used, for parents, it's often difficult to find that moment sometimes. Sometimes we see it, but a lot of times we don't. But once in parenting is in hindsight, those are the moments we really treasure. the new pair of sneakers, learning, you know, big things like learning how to ride a bike, but also kids' everyday discoveries. You know, these events that you have been having over the last few years, whether it be the beckoning of Lovely, which you can see on YouTube, or just any sort of the events you've been having, they're kind of like a flash mob in one sense, but in the other sense, I don't think they're really sketched out the way a flash mob would be. It's more like, let's see what happens. And here's an item, and let's see if we can make something of it. There's a bit of creativity and improvisation to a lot of these events you do.
Well, thank you. The first Beckoning of Lovely existed before I really knew what a flash mob was. So that, you know, that term hadn't yet entered into the system full on as it is now. So when I did the Beckoning of Lovely, I wasn't conceiving it in any way as a flash mob. It turns out, like, in hindsight, there's some similarities because I invited a bunch of people to come do this thing, and it was kind of a vague invitation to the universe, but I didn't know that's what I was doing at the time. And then the other things were more just inviting this community, the NPR blog community that I was working joyously with for a couple years, to come do stuff like the Life is a Marathon video, for example, where I said, you know, everybody who wants to come Thursday at 5 o'clock, meet me at this subway stop in Chicago, and we're going to greet commuters at the end of their workday in the same fashion you would be greeting marathon runners, with big signs and cheers and handing out water because life is a marathon, there's no finish line. Well, let's apply that aphorism, you know, let's live it. And so a bunch of people showed up, and it was so fun. And as you see in the video, like, the people being cheered for as they exited the train station and see all this commotion going on and all the posters, I mean, they loved it. But I think those doing the cheering had even more fun.
Right. And, of course, that is a flash mob-like event. But others, the Beckoning of Lovely, in the beginning and really, it seems like in the last few that you've done, there's been more of a less thought-out process to it. Or maybe it just looks that way.
There's really thought out. and I'm glad it gives the impression of something fluid and natural. And there's a lot of earnestness behind the gatherings. So, you know, I'm glad it doesn't feel mechanical. But I spend weeks and weeks and weeks and weeks concepting and structuring and writing out what's going to happen in the sense of the series of, like, moments that I'm offering to the group. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, things shift in the moment because that's how things work. But, for example, with the first Beckoning of Lovely, and you see us holding up the signs and, you know, make a friend, make peace, make music, make a grand entrance, that had been, you know, conceived ahead of time. And then what changed dramatically that evening was the fact that for the first gathering, I thought there might be 30 people, you know, or like 50 if I was lucky. And when I walked in and there were several hundred people, a huge crowd, I had to completely, like, shift everything that I had planned and say, okay, there's no time for rehearsal. I'm not going to be able to walk through this. Like, you know, I'm going to have to shout to the crowd and just shoot this as we go. So that changed. But the idea was there on paper.
Yeah. That started out of this very first video where you announced 17 things that you had made, and you're going to make an 18th Join Me at the Bean, which is the Anish Kapoor sculpture in downtown Chicago. You had several hundred people show up.
Yep.
You said, "You'll know me, I'm carrying a yellow umbrella." And out of that, you had several hundred people there. And it just, that was on 08-08-08.
At 8:08 p.m.
At 8:08 p.m. Had people show up. The next year, you didn't do a project. You just showed up on 9-09-09 at 9 a.m., I suppose, and offered people gifts of sorts. And then you've done it two other years, and I guess you finished in 11-11-11, which begs the question, how come there's no 12-12-12? You got one more year.
I know. Well, oh gosh. So when I started off on 8-08-08, I didn't have a plan of where it was all going. I wasn't thinking about it that way at all. I thought it was a one-time thing. But then, as you just said, I followed the beckoning of Lovely, sort of led me. It's really the best way to say it. So all those things happened. I went quietly back to the Bean on 999. I made that decision basically the night before. I wasn't going to do anything. So I went back by myself and just gave away Lovely. And then 10-10-10 and 11-11-11 were big gatherings again, where we invited, like, the universe, right? So the 12-12-12, I had, for various reasons that really made sense to me last year, had said that things had come to sort of full circle closure, and I was passing the beckoning of Lovely back on to kind of, you know, you. And so, and I meant it. I mean, that's really what happened. I left my umbrella behind that day, and you see that in the final video.
Right.
I left my umbrella, like, hidden in a bush after the event. But then a series of things transpired in very recently, in the last few months, that have propelled me to rethink what the beckoning of Lovely might be this last year. Because, right, there's no 13-13.
Right,
so I have a plan.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, I would be interested to see how many people will show up, even if you didn't announce a plan ahead of time, that if you said, I'm not going to do anything, I still think there would be people show up, because these events seem to really move a lot of people. And, of course, they've been viral on the internet, the videos of these events.
I would love to sort of just hide somewhere near the Bean sculpture, like tucked away where I could see what was going on and watch that day unfold and see who would come to the Bean. That would be wonderful.
There was also something that I think enters into your most recent children's book that sort of shows up in your TED Talks, and this idea of playing with words. For example, in one of the Beckoning of Lovelies, there was this great fascination with the color red. And it was like kindred. You used the word kindred, and it was kind and red. And this seems to be a part of your sense of play, is having fun with words and finding these sort of connections that are there, but we don't even really think about for the most part.
Yeah, I am completely drawn to these things. That is true. So the kindred, I kind of honed in on that the beckoning of Lovely was attracting kindred spirits. That seemed to be a pattern from the beginning, right? It was speaking to a certain group of people. The whole project resonated for you or it didn't. And then I thought, okay, the red thing. And then I just started, like, there seemed to be these things that sort of fell into my lap with red. For example, Quinn, the boy who in the first 8-0-8-0-8 beckoning of Lovely, and I said to the group, I need somebody to go up to a stranger and give them flowers. And this guy, Quinn, stepped forward. I didn't even know his name at the time. I didn't know him. He was a stranger. And so he did that. And then when I was trying to track him down for the 10-10-10 video, I knew that I wanted to bring this guy back, like if it would be possible. So I had to do some, like, investigative reporting, you know, kind of going through YouTube and seeing who his friends were. And long story short, you know, I figured it out. I tracked him down, found out his name is Quinn. Would you be up for this? And found out his last name is Rossi, I say this in the video, which he's Italian, and it means red. So, you know, is that the most incredible thing you've ever heard in your life? No. Is it kind of incredible? Well, kind of, you know? And the other, like, let's keep going with Quinn. This is not about red, but just here's another thing I like. So Quinn, and in the 9-9 video, remember one of the things I gave away, people could choose from a list of lovely things. And one of the things that they could choose from was a moment of peace, which was simply playing a song on my iPod. And there was one person who chose it. His name was Scott. Oh, I forgot about this. His name was Scott Redpath.
Right.
R-E-D. Okay, like, to me, like, what? Are you kidding me? So he tracked me down. I heard from him about a year after he was in my 9-9 video. He wrote me that he was in the Peace Corps, which I thought was incredible. Like, he chose a moment of peace, and then a few months later, he got accepted and went to the Peace Corps. So clearly, here's a guy who's, you know, in a space. And it was a beautiful letter, and then I decided, as you see in the 10-10-10 video, the song that was played on my iPod, we had those musicians, it's a Chicago band, we brought them back to play that same song live for the group that day, and we dedicated the moment to Scott, who was in Romania in the Peace Corps. And so there's the Redpath, and then he's in the Peace Corps, and he had chosen a moment of peace, and then I found out about a year later, Quinn had joined the Peace Corps. He's in Africa right now. So I love that. It just feels tidy and right.
Now, the statistician in me would say that's simply coincidence. But would you say there's something greater at work?
It is totally. I do love science, and I'm not looking to turn this into some kind of, like, I don't know, what's the right way to insult what I'm doing, spiritual nonsense or something. So all I'm saying is that these kinds of things, when they present themselves to you, you can take them for what they are, like maybe small gifts, or sometimes they feel like confirmation that you're kind of doing the right thing at the right time. Mm-hmm. So the fact that two of these key people in the Beckoning of Lovely journey, and that, you know, that I didn't know, right? They just showed up. And especially in 999, I didn't have a gathering. Scott happened to be walking by the bean that day. He happened to just come to take the moment of peace from my iPod, right? So I think it's kind of beautiful that these two people are in the Peace Corps. Like, it feels good to me.
Yeah. My guest today is Amy Krauss Rosenthal. She's the author of The Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life and over 20 children's books, including Wumbers, which is a combination of words and numbers, which if you get a text, you'll see that all the time, although that's kind of passe now. But she made a children's book about that, and she's also known for her viral videos, The Beckoning of Lovely, and she just finished up a project 2 years with our NPR Chicago affiliate, WBEZ, called Mission Amy KR, in which they do these events all over the city of Chicago, which was really interesting. That whole idea of going, I guess, taking the loop subway car, L train around, and just so you know, we're going nowhere fast, and
it's
sort of making a little wordplay with it, I think.
Yeah, we're all, sometimes we all feel like we're going nowhere fast. Well, let's go nowhere fast together. And we made a big circle around the city on the train on a Saturday morning. And I brought donuts, and I brought a guitar-playing friend of mine, and we talked about life, and we had donuts, and we sang, and we tried to get profound in, you know, 20 minutes or less, and it was awesome.
One of the things I think about is this is sort of adult play in many ways, and the way it connects with others. And it goes back to something, as I've watched the last few generations grow up, they don't have the experiences that my generation and older. I feel like I'm 50 years old, the last generation was told to go outside and play. You know, go out. You played your sports in backyards more than organized leagues. You know, your parents told you basically go find something to do outside. And so your imagination had to run wild because otherwise you were bored crazy. And when I look at past generations, they don't have those moments because of fears of, you know, whatever. And this sort of playing, this adult play, I think, touches people in a way that, I don't know. Do you think there's anything to that?
Tell me how this feels to you. I wonder if it's really, and I mean, I'll take that. That sounds good to me. I like it. But I wonder if it's really, is it play or is it just living? The things that I'm doing, they don't really feel exactly like play to me. I mean, it's very playful, but my work and my work life and my play life, there's no, it's all one, like it's all connected. I feel like the best thing we can do is kind of, as much as we can, be creating days around heightened living, right? Sometimes these gatherings, what people walk away saying is like, they sort of feel a heightened sense of aliveness. That feeling of like, you know, where you're kind of like happy on the tip of your tippy toes going like, oh my God, what's going on here? This is so cool. You know, like that feeling. So it is okay, maybe play, but it's also just full on living. I don't know.
Is that how you approach it? Not necessarily as having fun or playing, but just living.
I think so. I think there's, I don't know if I'm articulating what I'm thinking and feeling exactly right yet, because you really asked such a good question. But I'm not trying to inject like play or something that feels dramatically different than how I'm operating in general. This is an extension of my sort of truest being, and I'm trying really hard to just do the thing that I feel compelled to do, if that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Because going back to the first thing, like, all right, limited amount of time here. There's a lot of things any of us could be doing at any given moment on any given day. You know, what is it you really want to do, like, now? So that's the place I'm operating from.
Well, and it's interesting, you're also using the internet, which is sort of this depersonalized tool, to create these personal experiences and shared experiences.
I love it. I have been drawn to interacting with my audience forever, way pre-internet. So, like, back in the day when I started writing, I was connecting with, like, I was writing for magazines, and a couple of my books had just come out, and I was doing stuff with the P.O. box, right? So who can explain why? It doesn't even matter. But I've always been drawn to, like, putting something in my writing, like, you know, answer this question or reach out to me or penny for your thoughts. If you send me, you know, your thoughts, I'll send you back a penny. So, like, this has been going on forever. So I didn't know the internet was going to be born, right? I mean, this was, like, early 90s. And then along comes this amazing tool called the web and the internet. And suddenly these things that I had been drawn to all along, it just was like, are you kidding me? Like, I can do this? So I just feel really psyched and grateful that I am around and creating in this era where I have this at my disposal. I think it's phenomenal.
Now, you've been writing children's books for a number of years. Are you to the age where you're seeing grown-ups at some of your Beckoning of Lovely or some of your Mission Amy KR events that read your children's books as a child yet? Are you to that point?
Well, my first children's book came out in 2005. So
I was thinking it was like a late 90s.
My first book was published in 1998, so you're right. But that was an adult book, and so my first four books were all grown-up books, and first kid's book came out in 2005.
So not yet.
But, I mean, what is cool, I am seeing people at these events who, you know, their kids, like somebody might come to my work, let's say they come to the Beckoning of Lovely videos, either in person or they just see my stuff online, and then they realize, oh my gosh, I have your children's books at home for my kids. Like, a lot of times that happens where people don't realize, you know, they're like, I didn't know that was the same person.
Like there's a bunch of Amy Krauss Rosenthals running around.
That's actually my favorite thing is going, like, when I talk to kids or go to do school visits. I love hearing kids, like, don't call me Amy or Miss Rosenthal. Like, they come up to me like, hi, Amy Krauss Rosenthal. Like, it's one big entity. It's awesome.
Yeah. Now, I have to ask you one last question. When your Encyclopedia of an Ordinary Life came out, I thought this was the coolest idea. And I don't know if you did it all along the book tour or just in Chicago, but you would take copies of your book, and of course you made a video about this, and hide them in various locales in the city. And I'm talking like in a clothing store, hiding them under a sweater. I think somebody was street selling like the local rag, if you will, you know, the newsletter of what's going on in the city. And you said, next person who buys a copy, give them this book. You know, you put it on the seat of a theater. You know, all sorts of crazy things. Did you hear back from any of those people who?
Oh yeah. Totally. Now,
that was my hope and desire. I could just see where somebody go, "What is this?" You know, and just, you know, we're so blasé about our life most of the time. But tell me what you found out. What did people send back to you?
Well, I would hear from people who, yeah. So there's kind of two layers to it because, well, I did it. You're right. I did it in Chicago. As I launched the book, that was sort of the kickoff, and then I did it on my tour. I did it in San Francisco, and I also did it in London at one point. So it was really fun to see like how different cities responded. And you know, I would just get back really cool emails, like just exactly sort of what you would think. Like, I was just sitting on the bench and I saw this book and I didn't know, and then I saw this note and oh my gosh, it's so cool. Or I was at the grocery store picking apples and I saw this thing sticking out from the oranges and like, what? And it was a book. And, you know, it's just, it's really, really fun to hear from people. And then in my book, there was the story of something I had done similarly a couple years prior, which was hiding loose change around Chicago in envelopes. With a postcard saying you can spend this money however you want. I just like love to know what you do with it. And I heard from quite a few people, and the stories were pretty special. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, was there a city where you didn't get a good return on your investment as far as hearing back, or did just about every city where you went, they would send back notes?
Yeah, I mean, I didn't hear from everybody. Like, with sure. All these things I've just mentioned, both the Change Project and hiding the books, no, of course, there's, you know, like any direct marketing person will tell you, you know, if you hit, what is it, like 3% response,
yeah,
good.
Right.
But I heard from way more than three. I mean, there was really good response on all of it, enough to make the endeavor feel satisfying.
Yeah, well, it's a great idea. I mean, it seems like that's a part of your day every day is coming up with great ideas to make connections with people and I still say have some fun in living life.
Absolutely fun. You know what? Here's two ways I can summarize it. Maybe this is better than my rambling thing before. Two quotes. One thing that I've just sort of honed in on my own language, and then one that's said much better by somebody you'll recognize. So my work in progress statement is, as much as possible, spend your days doing things that make you want to skip, and skip the rest.
That's good.
So, you know, yeah, these things make me want to skip. But then here's the other one. You might have heard of Gandhi. And so he says, what you do is of little significance, but it is important that you do it. And that really feels right on the money for me, because maybe that's in some way, even though like skipping and play and having fun, that's really, really true and accurate. It's also, it feels important to me. So I'm doing it, even though I guess there's this little significance.
Well, I think you are touching a lot of people in the process. Amy Krauss Rosenthal, your latest book is titled Wumbers, the latest children's book. I know you have several coming out in the next year as well. Thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. It was fantastic talking to you.
Writer, filmmaker, and blogger Amy Krauss Rosenthal speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. If you'd like to see more of the videos we talked about in the interview, the best way to see it is her website, whoisamy, and that's AMY.com. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.